This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, and I'm joined, as always, by Bradley Chambers. Bradley, how's it going?
Good. We got open house tonight, so this is a annual Be at School for 13 Hours Day.
It's like a kind of weird solstice for teachers, isn't it?
It's like, live too far to go home, but I just end up sitting around for an hour. Probably go to dinner with my son, my oldest son, so that'll be fun. So still no iPhone 7 for me. I ended up getting a iPhone 7 Plus, 256 gigabyte, after I, even on the last show we were on, said there's no reason anybody should want that. But when I had a snafu with T-Mobile, like I called at 3:01 a.m., ordered the 128, it was supposed to ship, you know, by the 19th, and well, then they put my billing address as my name, like, and then, like, there was no street name at all. So, like, and for whatever reason, they can't update the address. I had to literally cancel the order, so I had to, like, kind of get in the queue again. And the 256 was shipping a whole lot faster, so I just, like, oh, whatever. And so mine should ship any day. It's supposed to ship between the 19th and the 26th. My wife did get hers, and camera is incredible, as you would suspect. I'll tell you, my whole process with my wife was the most interesting thing was, like, how easy it was to port a number. And I, you know, she had been on AT&T since like 2008. Like, I got her like the iPhone 3G. So I had not ported a number, and she was with Verizon, ported to AT&T. And like, I was able to do all of that without having to talk to a human. And I find that like remarkable, to be honest.
Yeah, that's a process. In the UK, that's been easy for a while now. You think you still have to talk to a human because they want an opportunity to persuade you not to leave. Like some kind of creepy ex-lover. But we've been doing that for a while because we've got like 5 mobile networks in the UK, so people move between them quite a lot. But one of the interesting things from my point of view with looking at new iPhones for the family and so on is that these kind of family plans that you guys have got a lot, those are starting to come in the UK. They haven't been very common here. There's a couple of networks now that are starting to provide like one shared pool of data that everybody can draw from. So we've been looking at that, and that seems like quite a good option with, you know, kids growing up and starting to want phones and stuff like that. So we're going to take a look at that as well. But I do not have a 7 either yet, but one is on the way.
The thing that's interesting about the porting process here in America is you don't even call your current carrier. You just have to have, like, your billing passcode, usually like a 4-digit PIN number. And I didn't port it. I don't think I mentioned this on the show. I didn't port it when I ordered the phone. I figured it was just like, I just wanted to order the phone, tell them I was getting the new number. And then when I got the phone, just port it at that point. And so like you basically initiated on Verizon's side. And so like that porting the number cancels the AT&T account.
Okay. So that's how they know that you've gone.
Right. They've ported the number and they just cancel the account and then like kind of wrap up your bill and all that. So it was really, really easy. My wife's on like the 4 gigabyte Verizon plan. One of the things that's really interesting, I mentioned the family plans, that, you know, T-Mobile, I have T-Mobile and had them for years. And, you know, their CEO's like, I don't know, he's like the Donald Trump of the mobile world. Like, in a way, like, you know, it's like there's like half of what he says I feel like is true, then half of it, it's like he's just very loud and brash. And that's fine. That's his persona. And like, that's fine. Like, I, you know, totally get that. And their service is like, especially just where I live, like it's hot and cold. And I would say we're probably a more rural area than like in Atlanta or New York or a San Francisco. And I hear it's like incredible in the big cities. And like here, it's like, it can be hot or cold. But I'm on Wi-Fi 75% of the time, so it's workable. But I'll tell you what's super handy about T-Mobile with having kids is like they don't, with their binge on demand and music freedom, they don't charge, like they zero rate your data for music streaming and video services. So that like really eliminates, like makes it like with your kids and data a whole lot easier to judge. Like last month I used like 6 gigabytes, but I only had like 2 gigabytes on network that actually, you know, kind of ate up into my data bank.
Yeah. I was looking at that with both my wife's phone and my own as well. And we both have, unlimited data contracts here in the UK. And I looked at the cellular data usage and it turned out that on average we had between us been using about 10 gigs a month. You know, I was using maybe 6 and she was using 4 or something, but it was much less than I thought we were using, you know, so that was something that kind of prompted me to take a look at that as well. Because I stream music, I stream Netflix freely over 3G and so on, and I never try to ration it and also use hotspot for the kids and things like that. So
that's not too bad.
It was interesting to me that it was as small as it was.
It's funny how here in the US, like unlimited was a thing and it went away and now it's coming back. Like, you know, of course, yeah. It's funny, like, when they say, I mean, even T-Mobile's unlimited. They're the ones kind of bringing it back. It's unlimited to 26 gigabytes.
Yeah, and, unlimited star.
Right, and so it's like, to me, that's, and then, like, tethering, so we don't have their unlimited plan at work. We're still on, like Simple Choice. We each get 10 gigs, and it has rollover, and have, like, 20, we each have 20 gigs in a rollover, because they kind of top it off to begin with. But mine comes with tethering, like LTE tethering, which is very fast. And the kicker with their unlimited plan is you have to pay extra, like, to tether at, like, LTE speeds. So it's like, if I was going over 10 gigabytes consistently, but I've gone over 10 gigabytes one time. And then that was by, like, half a gig.
Yeah, I think one of the things about when you have unlimited packages is people will pay a lot of money to be unlimited. But in fact, what I realized was that we were basically massively overpaying for the amount of data that we actually use. When we look at it, you know, we had been through a period of a few years where we had used it as hard as we wanted to use it for everything we wanted to do, and it turned out to be like 10 gigs a month, you know. And I would have, if you'd asked me without me measuring it, I would have said, oh, it must be 30 gigs or 40 gigs a month or something like that. But in fact, there's nothing like that. So I think, you know, if you never show an addict a total kind of thing, you know, so we'll get your unlimited plans here and charge you, like, you know, 1.5x what you really need to be paying for that amount of data.
Well, and you know what's funny is, this is like completely off topic, but like the month I went over is because I was traveling, and hotel Wi-Fi is, it's like the problem with it is, like, I'm on Wi-Fi at home and at work, so, like, not a problem. And it's only when I travel, because, like, generally public Wi-Fi is always a joke, and I would need a lot, like, those months I would need so the normal amount of data if, like, hotel Wi-Fi wasn't so bad. But it's like, I was in Denver for ISTE, and, like, my tethering is, like, faster than the hotel. And, like, it's not even like the hotel is, like, you know, 30 megs and my tethering's 80. It's like the hotel is 1 meg and my tethering's 80. Yeah. I mean, it's like, I don't know.
It may as well not exist, is the thing.
Well, you might as well, yeah, exactly. And so that's, like, for me, it's only when I travel. And so if I was the type of person that, you know, was out of town a couple times a month, I would probably use more. But just don't end up using that much. But like you said, it's something, it's like, for people just to say we have unlimited and you can do whatever, it's like, you know, you just in reality are not going to use as much as you think you will. On the flip side, every time I look at how much data we use at school, I'm always like, wow, that's a lot of data. We use, like, when I kind of track, like, in a week, like, how much data comes off the Wi-Fi, I'm like, that is a lot of service. But it's a lot of users, and, you know, it's a lot of, I mean, you know, even like with a caching server, there's things that eat up your space, not quota, but, like, it's usage. You know, you can eat up a couple gigs with Netflix in an hour.
I had a look. We put a Spotify as part of our solution. A lot of kids, the older kids, had installed Spotify in the previous deployment, and I was concerned that if I didn't deploy it, they would all just stream YouTube and blow out the bandwidth, because that's where they can get the free music kind of thing. So I put out Spotify, and then after a few weeks, I thought, well, how much Spotify are we actually using? And it was like nothing. You know, it was negligible compared to just, you know, web pages today. I mean, that's just such a big thing. HTTP just continues to be our largest source of traffic, and then YouTube is number two. And then SSL sites are number three, which you can't really read them. But Spotify is, like, you know, 10th place or something. It's about the same amount as iCloud backup. You know, it's nothing very big at all.
Well, I think that it shows that music streaming is just from a data perspective is just not that intensive.
No,
it's really, really not. Where, again, HTTP can be huge. And to me, like, when I look at ours, it's like anything to deal with, like, media, in terms of, like, pictures, like a Snapchat or an Instagram, like anytime you're uploading, like, videos like that, and you think about just any modern phone, how big those videos can get there very quickly. So, and that's, like, a concern. I mean, that would be my concern. Like, if you were at a school that, like, actually had a quota, I mean, you would just have to lock that sucker down, because you just don't, you know, you just don't realize how quickly you can burn through data with those kind of apps. Again, when you're in the car, you know, it's like Apple Music, Spotify, things like that. And it's not that intensive. But, you know, when you're uploading, you know, video clips and whatnot, it can get quite large, which is, it kind of goes back. I find interesting that there's no way to force an iCloud photo library upload on cellular. Like, there's just no way to override that.
Yeah, you just can't do it.
Which,
yeah.
I wish you could, but that's just me.
Yeah, I mean, if you do have that unlimited plan. I mean, I ran into that situation that you're talking about with I had shot some video in the class of kids doing presentations, and I wanted to put them on Google Drive so that I could share them back with the kids without them having to download it again. And I was kind of shocked. I had forgotten just how data intensive shooting video is on the iPhone. I mean, these were like 5-minute video clips, and it was like 500 megs for some of these files, you know. And I had not turned it down. There's a setting in camera where you can turn it down from 1080 to 720. And I hadn't done that. And I was kind of being lazy. And normally what I would do is take the file into iMovie and then export it as a small size and then put it onto Google Drive. But I thought, well, why not just throw them up into Google Drive because it's free? And then realized why I hadn't done that last year was because the amount of time it took to get those videos up to the cloud was just crazy. And, you know, with phones coming out now with like a 4K video camera and stuff like that, I'm sort of like, why would I ever turn that on? You know, I'm thinking about going down to 720.
For yeah, it's like it's like 4K is the exception.
Yeah.
But iOS 10 is out, and so is macOS Sierra. Sierra for me is the Mac. I think I mentioned on a previous show, like the Mac upgrade's interesting. Like I'm really finding that the desktop and document syncing is like huge for me. And I'm really finding that helpful, like having those folders in iCloud Drive on iOS. Tim said it right, like that's where our files go. And I'm finding it very helpful to be able to like save PDFs and stuff from my email and mobile devices just straight to my desktop. iCloud Drive's been working really well for me. I've actually been testing iCloud Photo Library. Going well, I had to go up in storage, obviously. And I had something a little while ago where I added some photos to photos on my Mac, and like I was trying to send them as a text to my wife, and like it had the cloud icon. It said cannot download these right now, and like I literally had to reboot my phone to fix it. So, but that's the first hiccup I've had.
Yeah, I found that just over the period when iOS 10 was coming out, the iCloud Photo Library was a little weird for me too. You know, I was trying to play back some of those videos that had clearly been optimized away from my phone. Another reason to get a 256, by the way. And it was really stuttery. It was just like, you know, grind. It was a short video, like 2-minute video. It was stopping like 3 or 4 times. Seems to be a bit better now. I don't know if it's just network busyness or something on my part, but I haven't normally seen that. So,
not a ton of new iPad features on iOS 10. Again, it looks like, I mean, we will see in the spring if the 0.3 upgrade is the iPad upgrade every year. Split screen Safari. That's actually one of those features, like before it exists, you like kind of don't think about it, and then it exists and you're like, this is the greatest thing ever. Like it really is helpful.
yeah. And it's the kind of thing where you're sort of like, well, why doesn't the desktop browser do that as well, you know, just splitting the window into two? I mean, I know you can make two windows and then arrange them that way, but it's not quite the same
right
thing.
not as that kind of just forced.
A few little tips on that, by the way. I don't know if you noticed these, that you can, if you have the split view open, and you can tap a link with two fingers and that opens it in the other side. It was a really cool little shortcut. And if you press and hold, you know the little two squares icon in Safari for like show me all the open tabs in a grid? If you push and hold that, you get a number of options, one of which is open split view, which is one way to explain to people how to get to split view. But the other thing you can do in there is there's a button in there that lets you close all the tabs, which is really cool. If you've been really busy, you just go close all the tabs.
Oh, yeah. I've used that on my phone, so. And that is nice. We did get the solution for changing Bluetooth, which just affects Apple Classroom.
Sort of.
It's a Band-Aid, but it's not ultimately how I think this feature should be implemented. You would like to be able just to like, You word this better.
Yeah, I mean, explain what the situation we have is, right, which is that there's now a configuration profile option where you can say allow changing Bluetooth settings, right? And the wording is very important there. It's allow changing Bluetooth settings, because what it does is if you deploy that profile, right, and you bring that shutter down, then whatever state the Bluetooth is in on a device when that profile lands is what you're locked into, okay? So the first thing is, if people have already got Bluetooth turned off and you drop that profile on them, then their Bluetooth is going to be locked off forever, right? If it's on, it's all going to be on forever, of course. So you have to kind of know or be aware or find out somehow what state people's Bluetooth is in before you send the profile. The way I've been handling that in the school is like 90% of people do keep Bluetooth on all the time. But for the people who don't, I sort of know who they are, right? Benefit of a small school. And then what I've done is I've scoped the profile for Bluetooth control to people running iOS 10. Because it seemed to me that if you put that profile out and then you upgrade to iOS 10, it doesn't take properly for some reason. So, and you need to only put it on devices that you know are already on iOS 10. So that was my scope for that profile. But then what I would do is I'd put in a manual exclusion or manual exception for the people who I wanted to change their Bluetooth settings. So if I had somebody in a class and I couldn't see them in Apple Classroom, I'd say, let me see your iPad. You can check. If you go into settings, you can still see the Bluetooth state. But it's grayed out. The control is grayed out, so you can't change it. And then I would put an exclusion in the profile, get to the switch, turn it on, remove the exclusion, and that was that problem solved. But pretty tedious to do that for a big school. It's not really a scalable option. So there's no control for force on or force off. It's just stop people changing whatever state it's in at the moment, which is kind of, yeah, it works, you know, if your deployment is brand new and everything's on before you give it to anybody to mess it up, then that's fine. But, you know, you really want to be able to force it either way. But there's also implications for pairing devices as well. Right, see, this is the thing. It's prevent changing Bluetooth settings. And inside that word settings is included both the power state of Bluetooth, but also which devices the iPad is paired with, right? So I had a kid who was bringing a Bluetooth keyboard, and he came to me and said, look, I can't connect my Bluetooth keyboard to the iPad anymore. That wasn't completely true, right? He was misunderstanding what he had to do to connect it. He was repairing the device every time, and that's why he couldn't get to it. But I said, look, just turn it off and turn it on again, and it will reconnect when you turn the keyboard back on. So that was fine for that. But then other kids were like, well, I've got these Bluetooth headphones that I sometimes pair with my iPad, sometimes pair with my phone, and now I can't do anything with that. And I just had to say, oh, sorry about that. You can't use your Bluetooth headphones with your school iPad at the moment. But I did file a bug about this, and it has been marked as a duplicate. So I think the way I would kind of want to cut this, Bradley, is I would want to have, you can't change the Bluetooth power state, but you can freely pair and unpair and repair devices, because that's not something I want to control. I can understand why some people would want to control it, but it's not something I care about. It's more of an enterprise thing, I think.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, because certainly from like a security perspective, I could see that. But also, the way this is like implemented feels like a oh crap thing in May with Apple Classroom.
And the thing that kids have already discovered is that if you put airplane mode on, you can still hide from Apple Classroom, right? But then obviously having airplane mode on is not
very useful.
Very useful much of the time. But I'm slightly concerned that I've now created a situation where people want to turn on airplane mode, and then they're sitting in airplane mode for most of the day, and they only turn it on when they need to so that they can be seen. Now, to be fair, not many people are doing this, but there are one or two individuals who are to be suspected of foul play, shall we say. But it was interesting to note that the Apple Pencil is exempt from this, right? So you know how you pair an Apple Pencil by plugging it into the Lightning port rather than doing Bluetooth discovery. I could pair an Apple Pencil with a device that had prevent Bluetooth settings turned on. So it was interesting that kind of got a pass, whereas other things didn't.
It's almost like it's got its own, like kind of like the W1 chip, it's got its own pairing process.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if that was true.
iOS 10, you know, as a whole, I've got a couple devices on it. We've got a bug in one of our apps where it forgets the settings, and so I'm kind of not, every time you launch it. So I haven't gone in like mass started uploading, but as soon as I see the update for that app drop, I will kind of start rolling that out slowly. The ones I did do, what was nice is there's no new settings to click through, so it almost feels like a point upgrade. Like you kind of have to click, you know, continue from the welcome to upgrade, but other than that, you know, good to go. And
no, it's working fine for us too. We've had 100% success rate for about 90 to 95 devices so far over the past week. It's been absolutely fine. No problems at all. And caching server is doing a great job of pushing that out for us as well. So the only thing that's been a wee bit disappointing though is that the process by which you can push an update from your MDM server, that hasn't worked as well as I had hoped. In that, if your device has got a passcode set, what you need to do is you need to, the user needs to put in their passcode before the update can happen. And I think it's something to do with it, like generating a temporary security key so the device can boot up again or whatever. But it's not been as hands-off as I had hoped it would be. What I have done is I've used that command to to force the devices to download the update from our caching server at specific times in the day. But overall, that's not been quite as smooth as I had hoped. It's been a bit annoying, really.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of ran into that as I was going to 9.3.5. Like, it just wasn't. It would, like, take sometimes, but it wasn't 100% success rate. And I don't really know. I don't think that would be the Casper suite because, I mean, it can only do so much. It's almost like the iPad's not initiating. I don't know if, like, it's something about the state the device is in at the time or I don't know.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of situations. I mean, one, I believe if you do have a passcode, you have to get the user to type it in because it creates a temporary key or something like that. There is a video somewhere where it explains why that is. But the other thing that can interrupt it is if it's under 50% battery, you push that and the event will fail because there's not enough battery power to install either. So that's another reason it can fail. But we're getting there, you know, and it's fine. It's not urgent that we update or anything like that. Except for the fact that their MDM server is trying to push out apps that can't be installed on those devices, right? I'm talking about iWork 3, for example, right? The iWork version that just came out alongside iOS 10. It requires iOS 10, as most iWork updates that come along with the operating system do. So what I've seen over the course is for the devices that are still on 9.3.5, what was happening was the MDM server was pushing an installation, a reinstallation, or a so-called update of an app that wasn't installable. So it was basically re-updating the same version of Keynote and Pages and Numbers as was already on the device, which was inconvenient, but it was a bandwidth hog, but it wasn't damaging anything as such. But that otherwise, though, that's been quite good. I don't know if you've seen this, Bradley, but the device management server keeping apps up to date is actually working really well for us. So if you go in into GSS, for example, and you search for a specific mobile app, and it can show you a list of all the different versions that are installed on different iPads, and we're seeing like much, much less variation in that version number across the school than we had before when it was up to everybody to run their own app updates. Now, you would see like sometimes you see like 5 or 6, 7, 8, 9 different versions of an app being used in the school, whereas now there's just, you know, the current version and the version minus one for a few people that haven't had the push yet. But that is working really, really well.
Yeah, that's just one of those, it makes the hands-off kind of environment. And especially we've had apps that, like the older versions will just like quit working. Like it's like a cloud thing and it's like they just say you gotta update this app. And that's where it's really handy as well.
Although there's no way that I know to force the MDM to push an update right now, which is sometimes what you want if you get somebody in front of you going, I don't have the new version, can I get it? I don't know if there's a button somewhere in GSS that you can press that says, you know, push all the updates you've got to this iPad now. Because I know that the server knows about newer versions and has known about them for a long time, but in some cases hasn't pushed them to particular devices yet, and I'm not sure what it is makes that happen.
I just always, like, my rule of thumb is turn on airplane mode, turn it off. Send a blank push from the JSS and update inventory. Mm-hmm. Figure if I do one of those three things, it'll finally get it.
Yeah, I should probably ask support about that.
So what else we have here?
Those iWork apps.
Yeah,
interesting things in there.
Yeah, I know you did like a big like Twitter collaboration. I think was there 15 mm-hmm. people on there at one time?
Yeah, we saw 15 to 16 concurrent users at one time, and over the course of about 25, 30 minutes, we saw over 35 different people go in and edit that deck. And this is the collaboration feature, and we're using it in Keynote, for example. And I was really impressed with it. It was fast and responsive. There were people who were connecting from web browsers on Windows PCs. People, I was looking at it on my, I initiated the whole thing from my phone. Other people were on iPad and so on. And I found it to be really, really, really impressive. You know, Google Docs class impressive and performant and reliable and everything. So really quite impressed with that. I think my criticism from a couple of shows back though holds, Bradley, which is that it's hard to build a workflow in this because there's no collaboration at the storage level. And that's the thing that kind of wins for Google Drive is that when I'm on Google Drive, I can share a folder and anything I put in that folder gets shared with all the people who that folder shared with. Whereas with iCloud, it's necessarily every single share is an ad hoc share. Here's this file, here's that file, and you get a bunch of URLs flying about. And how do you manage that? Not very easy. But, you know, they've done the hard part of those two things.
Well, and it's, I think the plumbing is there, and certainly in Sierra. I know, like, that document ended up appearing in my iCloud Drive under Keynote, and it even said on the Mac, like, shared from Fraser Spears. But, yeah, and that's one of the benefits of the way Google Drive works. It's like you can just share a folder, and anything in that folder, you don't have to, like, you know, individually share that. So hopefully that'll be coming. One of the things that it's kind of – I've seen a couple apps do this is – and it's in iWork – is the persistent sidebar and toolbars on the bigger iPad. I do like that because that's, to me, again, going back, getting the iPad closer to desktop-style workflows, and certainly on those more creative apps, it's like you get the bigger screen, just let me see the toolbars all the time.
Yeah, so this is the thing where in the older versions of Keynote, you had a number of popover menus at the top right corner, the brush and the plus sign and so on. And with the 3.0 versions, you can just have them persistently out to view. It's fine for Keynote. It works fine for Keynote. Where it's really good is in Pages because, you know, obviously you're working kind of narrow and tall on a word processing document. So that's really nice. And I think that's a design trend that is welcome on iPad Pro sized apps as well. There's other new things in there, like there's new keyboard shortcuts. And apparently not all of them are shown in the heads-up display when you push and hold the command key. Some of those are there's so many shortcuts, apparently, they can all fit them in there. So there's some things like, you know, you can use, I think it's Command-Shift-N for new slide in Keynote. That's something I had an outstanding request on for a very long time, because when you're making a Keynote deck on iOS, you want to just hit Command, you know, new slide, and it was always something you had to, you know, lift your hand up and press a button to do. So there's a lot of good stuff in there. They're all listed in the help document, so it's worth just searching for keyboard shortcuts in the help documents for all those apps, and you can see a list of things you can do with a keyboard.
I mean, just like it is on the desktop, getting away from the mouse and using keyboard shortcuts is just going to make you immensely faster, and certainly on iOS, mm-hmm. It's more ergonomic as well, to keep from having to, like, move your hand up and down on the screen.
Yep. So that's all very interesting. The other thing, about if you use iCloud with iWork, is that they're now, when you've got a lot of documents in iCloud, they're now lazily downloading them only on demand, rather than sort of forcibly downloading your entire library of Pages, Keynote, and Numbers documents in the cloud. But you can turn this off, right? So this is something I've turned it off for Keynote, because I want to have all my Keynote files on my iPad. Because some of them are very big, right? So some of them might be 400 or 500 megs, and if I'm away on some speaking trip where I've not got network, or the network's really slow or something, I don't want to have to stand in front of the crowd and download that. So you can turn off that lazy downloading, but I've left it on for Pages because, well, mainly because I don't use Pages as much as I use Keynote.
Yeah, and I think I could see that for Keynote, but, like, yeah, Numbers I could kind of care less. It's just going to depend on the app. So yeah. And yeah. I am, like, the way that works on Sierra is kind of, it's more of an iCloud Drive thing as a whole, and you could set it to kind of store it only in iCloud if you don't have the local storage. So, like, on my Mac right now, I have, like, a terabyte drive, so it's huge. But it right now, it says capacity, you know, basically 999.33 gigabytes. Available, 937.08. But it says 188.91 gigabytes purgeable. And so it's like saying I've only used 62 gigs on the disk, but I've really used 200 plus. But it's just got some of that marked as purgeable.
Yeah. So if the day comes, it can get rid of it.
Right. It's like it can get rid of, like, you know, it can start offloading iCloud photo library and things like that. Mm-hmm. I don't think I'll ever get to that place. But, yeah, you never know.
Yeah. I mean, I was just thinking there, though, one of the places where that kind of lazy downloading of big Keynote files would be really good is on a phone. Right, where you might want Keynote on your phone, but you might only want it every so often for one particular task rather than having your whole library there.
Yeah, well, one thing I was going to mention on this, with these storing these all these documents in there, is because Keynote files can get kind of big. I'm, like, actually ticking up to where I'm going to have to go to a terabyte of iCloud storage. And so I'm thinking there should be a $5 a month plan that's, you know, 500 gigabytes. Because it's like I'm going to have to go.
Well, there used to be, didn't there?
Yeah, I'm going to have to go to 201. In fact, once I hit 201 gigabytes, I'm at like 180 right now. I'm going to go from $299 to $999 a month.
Yeah, which is like Netflix money. Yeah,
yeah, and it's like it's going to take me forever to get, you know, like, you know, the 183 right now I'm using, 165 of it is, like, you know, iCloud Photo Library. Well, I'm not going to, I mean, I'm going to obviously add some every year, but I'm not going to get to a terabyte, like, next year. So I feel like I'm paying a lot of money for storage I'm not using in a way. So it's like I kind of could see there being a middle ground there.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure there used to be a 500 gig level, and when they brought the terabyte out, they dropped it. So there is a huge jump from 200 gigs to a terabyte. I've been on terabyte for a while because I've got like over 300 gigs in iCloud photo library.
I had a school call me today asking, hey, how do we manage? We just got signed up for Apple School Manager. How do we like give them more iCloud space? It's like, sorry. Anyways.
You may think that's a simple question.
Yeah, that is not a simple question. These are all, I mean, I see a lot of this as like building blocks towards the future, though.
Well, you know, we talked about iOS 10 on the last episode of Canvas as well. And the comment I made was every time we talked about iOS 10, we also talked about iOS 11, which is like there's so much stuff where you can see, well, if you had this and then you got that and then you get something else, you could have this amazing thing, you know. Like, for example, one of my ideas was like if you could, proximity to your Apple Watch would keep your phone unlocked, then the iOS 10 home screen suddenly gets the lock screen suddenly gets a lot more useful if it's constantly unlocked rather than having to touch ID.
I want the dashboard thing to be the main screen.
Yeah. Yeah, I would like that too. Yeah. Let me tell you about Keynote Live, which was a complete surprise feature. They never mentioned that in the iPhone 7 keynote at all. But Keynote Live, and it only exists for Keynote. I don't think you can do this with any of the other apps. Keynote Live is basically live playback of Keynote files across the internet, right? From you to multiple users, okay? And it's named Keynote Live for a reason, which is that it's a live performance of your keynote. It's not like uploading your deck to SlideShare, where then people can just go and browse it at any time. They have to be synchronously watching the presentation with you giving the presentation, right? So what you do with this is in any keynote deck you're in, you just say, you know, use Keynote Live. And what you can do then is you get a URL that you can share with people through whatever means, and then they connect to that URL. And depending on what platform they're on and what software they have, different things happen. The lowest level is you connect to it through a web browser, okay? And you get a certain quality of playback. If you have Keynote 3 installed on either a Mac or an iOS device, you can actually, Keynote will actually play the stream back as well. Now, it's not a video stream, I believe. It's a little more sophisticated than that. But your Keynote will upload your deck to iCloud and then give you a URL. That URL is apparently persistent. So, for example, you could put the URL of all your Keynote decks into your iTunes U course, and then students could just connect to it, and you open the file and start playing it, and it would play back on their screens. Now, that's something that's really interesting to me, because can you then be in a world where you, if you want to use Keynote, and okay, you want to use other apps as well, but could you present to students without them, without using a projector during classroom, for example? That you could just present directly to their iPads.
That's a great point.
Maybe.
What's the idea of a projector? It's so everybody can see the same thing easily at the same time.
Yeah. And it would be nice. I mean, I hope that's a precursor. Again, here's an iOS 11 feature. Can I do that with any app? Can I do it with my iPad screen? That would be cool. But obviously the question, once you get onto, you know, I'm doing this on the web, is, well, is it the same? Is everybody seeing the same thing? And I think the answer is no, actually, to this, although I haven't tested every single thing that Keynote can do. But my understanding is that if you are playing back to other instances of Keynote, they can see everything that you can do, right? So you can play a video and the students will see it. You can do all the animations, all the transitions in Keynote, and Keynote Live will play them back in Keynote on other devices. If you're viewing on the web, however, there are some things that you can't do. But I don't know what those things are yet. The only one I've discovered is the flame build where you sort of burn something up on the slide. That doesn't run on the web. But some other sophisticated things do, like Magic Move does work on the web, right? So the web client is actually pretty sophisticated, but it's not quite as sophisticated as some of the sort of hardware accelerated animations that there are in Keynote for iOS and Mac. And the other thing to note about Keynote Live is that it doesn't have an audio channel, so it's not really your WebEx killer just yet. It's only for your control of the slides, and you'd have to broadcast audio some other way. So it's not a full solution for remotely presenting to somebody else yet, but if you're on the phone call and then you can start up your Keynote Live, you get a conference call and Keynote Live going at the same time, that could totally work.
Yeah, it's true. Like, you just a quick sales presentation or something like that. And certainly, yeah, having the persistent URL. It's all, I mean, especially considering we weren't, you know, thinking this would be there. I know Google Slides has something similar to this, and they've got some additional features as well. But, you know, the biggest thing is it truly works well on iOS. Keynote does. Google Slides is okay on iOS. We've been using it some past few weeks. It's fine. I mean, it's workable. It's not nowhere near as interactive as Keynote.
No.
But, yeah, so you have some neat, again, neat building blocks for the future.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much stuff is sort of like, this is good, but it could be this if you added something else, you know. If you could have Keynote Live over FaceTime, suddenly that gets pretty interesting.
Ah, yeah, think about that.
Yeah, it's, imagine Apple owned a voice over IP streaming protocol that they controlled both ends of. Wouldn't that be interesting?
It'd be very, very, very interesting. So, yeah, I'm kind of curious to see where this goes. I don't know. Yeah, it's you know, everything I've read is nobody's complained about the quality or just the stability of it. But I think the biggest thing, kind of going forward on all this, is need persistent storage and like shared folders and iCloud Drive would kind of solve this. Because Kane and I even create shared links in iCloud Drive yet. And so that's kind of table stakes at this point. So that's why I've still got Dropbox installed on my Mac at all, is for things like that.
Cool. So that's two of the three big things. And the other thing that's worth talking about, I think, Bradley, is Swift Playgrounds.
Yes.
Which are finally out as well.
Yeah, you have an article in Mac Stories, one of my, probably my favorite website, certainly done with technology. I'm a Club Mac Stories member, and it's like just, I don't know, Federico's just like a really neat guy. The whole staff is like very friendly, just feels like, just like one of us, in terms of, I want to say one of us, I mean like just regular people, and just really passionate about this stuff and thinking of new ways of using it. So there's my plug for Club Mac Stories, and we'll have a link to your article in the show notes as well. Very, very cool stuff if you're wanting to learn more about just what is Swift Playgrounds and how is it different than Xcode.
Yeah, so I wrote this article over the course of a couple of days, a week ago or so, after the final version of Swift Playgrounds had come out, because I wanted to see, you know, was it the same or different to the version that I saw at WWDC? And it was significantly different, but it wasn't hugely different. But they had fixed a lot of the small things, like they had added a speed control for the playback of your code. So one of the criticisms we had of the first version that we saw was that it was fine to watch it slowly animate the first time as you sort of learned what was happening. But as you fixed bugs, it got more and more annoying because you had to sit through this sort of 2 or 3 minute animation of your code when you've understood most of it and it's like the last move was wrong the first time, so you got to sit through all this again. So they now have a 4x button on that, so you can make the thing scream through it.
Yeah, the code.org Lightbot apps have that, and it's like the worst is when it's on, you don't need to be on, but when you're like in the last section of it and you're like, what is breaking here? That is very, very helpful.
Yeah. So they've finished both of the books as well. I mean, this is the very interesting thing about this is that it's not just the app, but it's also the app. There are two books built into the app called Learn to Code 1 and 2. And these are an introductory and a slightly more advanced level interactive textbook, basically, which run inside Swift Playgrounds, right? So the code is actually editable and runnable inside the book, which is super cool. I mean, I'm really impressed with it. And Apple have invested a lot of money and time and expertise in building a small curriculum in those two books where you can go from knowing nothing about programming to understanding essentially basic computational thinking and a fair bit of the basic syntax of Swift. And I have been super impressed with those books. I think they're some of the nicest computer science resources I've seen for that kind of age group, sort of 9 to 11 years old. And we're going to use it. We're going to start in about 3 or 4 weeks' time with one class in the school. We're going to start with that book, Learn to Code 1, and we're just going to use that book in class and see how we get on.
Free textbooks.
Free textbooks are great, yeah. And I'm hoping that within years to come, we can build up more sophisticated things. Because the thing about Swift Playgrounds is that it actually gives you access to a huge amount of the iOS API, right? So you can do things like, you can do core Bluetooth operations, you can do networking, you can use WebKit, you can do all kinds of cool stuff. And there's a few things you can't do. For example, one of the things you can't do is MapKit, which is a bit of a shame because I thought it would be really cool to do a lot of programming around about maps and locations and things like that. But MapKit is not accessible from Swift Playgrounds, but most other things are, including things like the camera roll, for example. So you can actually throw up your own camera picker and do things like that, and build your own camera in it, I believe, as well, things like that. So it's a very interesting product already. I think Swift is a good language for teaching. I don't know enough about it yet to know if it's my absolute favorite teaching language ever. So far, that crown still is held by Ruby, despite me teaching Python right now. But I think it has a lot of advantages for education, some of which I don't really know enough to articulate yet, but it feels kind of right and feels kind of solid and understandable. And the way that the editor works in Swift Playgrounds, you can do all kinds of cool stuff. Like if you've got a for loop which has got two curly braces either end of the code, you can actually drag the lower brace and exclude or include code from your loop just by dragging the bottom edge of it up and down, which is kind of cool, because that's something that kids always struggle with, is, you know, where does this loop start, where does it end, and so on. And as I sort of suspected when I was going to start teaching it in Python, that's really hard for kids to understand. So I'm a big enthusiast for this. And I think those apps are, the books are going to be really attractive to kids as well.
These are one of those things to think about when like you read those, like the iPad costs $1,000, but yet their bill of materials is $200. Like these are the things that they're paying for as well, that you're not counting in those kind of cost.
Well, I mean, all the stuff we've talked about tonight, we've talked for 40 minutes, right? And the only thing we've paid for is when we talked about the phones we were going to buy at the start, right? All of that iOS 10 stuff, all of that Apple School Manager stuff, all of iWork, all of Swift Playgrounds, all that curriculum content, you know, that's where that premium goes. Is to
Right. So, yeah, we're excited about that, and we'll be excited to hear more about your journey as you go along with that. So it'll be fun.
We'll definitely keep in touch.
Do like a monthly catch-up or something. Sounds like a good place to leave it for this week. I've got fun open house tonight, so I'm going to take my son, go get him some Chick-fil-A. I talked to my wife and I said, should I just let him pick? And she's like, you know, he's going to pick McDonald's. And I do not want McDonald's. There's something about like getting older that the thought of like eating a McDonald's hamburger makes me want to throw up. It's not worth.
Do you have Five Guys there?
We do. And Five Guys is incredible, but it's like, you know, I'm doing a 100-mile relay race this weekend and I would have to do that to burn off the burger and fries I would eat.
Yeah. I don't know. Is Five Guys like really expensive in the States?
No, it's not too bad. It's like more than
here. It is a fortune. Yeah, it's a ripoff here.
Yeah, it's like a less than a premium sit down place, obviously, but it's like a little bit more than McDonald's. But it's worth it. I mean, it's a great value. It's a great burger. My body style is such that if I look at like something like that, I gain 3 pounds just by looking at it. So I've been trying to like, I don't know, I'm getting older. You know, it's harder to keep. I realize it's just going to be harder and harder to keep the weight off. So I'm as well trying to watch what I eat now. I'm getting old.
Well, the kind of pricing for Five Guys in the UK is such that that's not going to be such a problem. Just give you a ballpark measurement, right? A burger, fries, and a drink in Five Guys here is about £14.
Good night.
Which is about maybe $17-$18.
Yeah, it's like probably like $10 here.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like 3x McDonald's, right? And it is nice, but, you know, you can't take the family. No. Like 50 quid to take the family.
No, it's like, now that we have kids, I realize, like, so many things are so impractical. Like, going out to dinner, movies, anything, it's so impractical. It's like, go to Chick-fil-A $45 later. Like, what? Don't even eat half of it.
That's why people go to McDonald's.
Bingo. Yeah. So anyways, hope everybody has a fantastic week. We'll have some links to everything we talked about at outofschool.net. If you haven't rated us in iTunes in a while, that would be awesome. And as always, share the show with your friends. We appreciate that. You can connect with me on Twitter, Matt Bradley Chambers. Love to talk to listeners of the show. Or if you want to contact me via email, you can find that. My website is chambersdaily.com.
Okay, and I am spears.org on the web and Fraser Spears on Twitter.
Have a good week, everybody.